episode of We the People Radio. I'm Marge Simpson.
Oh, no. Wait, Marge, are you back?
Stay at the fair all week. You can sound like Marge Simpson, too. Well, Bill, who's our sponsor this hour?
Yes, my name is Bill Cundiff, and our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere Ag and Turf dealer. Pape has a wide range of tractors and mowers and implements to choose from. Go by and see them. They're located at 3119 Twinview Boulevard in Shasta Lake. And they also do service parts, and you know, they can work on anything. Just give them a call. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or you can catch them on the web at PapeMachinery.com. There you go.
2269226. I know that by heart now.
Yeah, you're doing good.
3119 Twinview Boulevard. I can do it kind of in the rain, like in the Rain Man.
What'd you say?
Motif.
What'd you say? What address was it?
Isn't it 3119 Twinview?
Yeah, 31. I thought you said 32.
Oh, no, 3119.
Yeah, 31.
And the Gorton's Fisherman thing is fixed, yeah. so now it's a big banner that says John Deere.
Yeah, take his fishing coat away and put up a new banner, so.
Oh, my goodness. What was the other thing? Oh, we saw our friend Wayne Facca at the fair, and Wayne missed our free commercial that we did.
He did?
Yeah. You better do it again.
Yeah. I can't. I don't have it. We'll do it at the bottom of the hour.
Okay. All right.
Give him a little promo.
We'll do that. And, you know, we saw a bunch of people who listen to the program all the time. Kay and her sister stopped by the booth. And so we got a lot of feedback from people in real life. It was fun. So if you have ideas and guests or, you know, people you've written cool books or, I don't know, just people you'd like to hear more from, you can always find us at WeThePeopleRadio.us. Our phone numbers and email addresses are on there. If you want to call me at 4 o'clock in the morning and leave me a lewd message, though, that's kind of not that.
Yeah, that's not cool.
You could skip that. You could just
If you are going to do it on a
block line.
On a block line, not one that has your name on it. That's not cool.
Yeah, 401 drunk dial without blocking your number. Anyway, good times. Good times for everyone. So let's see. We are talking about inflation this hour. How timely. Our friend Stephen Manfredi, the publicist from Virginia, I believe. He is the Manfredi Strategy Group. He is the greatest. He's always sending us somebody interesting. And Liam is our new engineer. Hello, Liam.
Hello.
Hi. So do we have Mr. Lewis on the phone?
We do not, no.
Oh, we do not. Okay.
I haven't gotten a phone call, but...
Did you call him?
No, I didn't.
It's right there on that post-it note, right by your right hand.
I'm very sorry about that. Let me give him a call. Okay,
you're
guys.
Brand new. We get it. We'll just keep stalling for time.
Thank you.
It's because we were at the fair all week, which is why I have the Marge Simpson voice. So let's see. Let's do a little bit about Mr. Lewis so we don't blow time just doing that while he's on the phone. So the book, it's about a book. It's called Inflation. What is it? Why is it bad? And how to fix it. Written by Steve Forbes, Nathan Lewis, and Elizabeth Ames. So, about Steve Forbes, everybody's heard of him. Nathan Lewis, he's among the world's world's leading authorities. Totally different from least. Leading authorities on monetary policy and economic history. He's the author of The Magic Formula, The Timeless Secret to Economic Health and Prosperity, Gold, The Once and Future Money, Gold, The Financial Times, The Monetary Polaris, and Gold, The Final Standard. So he writes on gold a lot. That is really a big topic for him. A Discovery Institute fellow, his writing has appeared in Forbes, the Financial Times, and elsewhere. Publishes the Polaris Letter, a monthly investment newsletter available at newworldeconomics.com. And I've linked all that up on the website. Pretty darn great. So, he's on there with us, eh?
Hello.
Hey, how are you? I'm sorry, Liam's in there doing hand signals and trying to write down a thing. Sorry about that, buddy. you can just shoot me a message on Skype. We can secretly talk on Skype. That'll be easy. We have a new engineer this week. He is taking over, and so we have not worked with or met him before. So, Mr. Lewis, I just gave everybody your little 411 there. You are obviously an expert on gold. It's unfortunate we're not talking about that today, but let's do that in the future, for sure. But inflation is the timely topic. I don't know where you'd like to start with this, but we would be happy to follow along because I think people are getting a lot of mixed messages on inflation.
Yeah, where's it coming from? What happened?
Good question.
Edible,
so I did write a few books about gold. I call it the Gold Trilogy. It's not necessarily about investing in gold, although that's in there. It's mostly about the history of and the practice of using monetary systems based on gold, which we did for almost 200 years in this country up until 1971, and as long as we stuck with that principle, never had an inflation problem. So it is actually related to our topic today. The newest book I have out with co-author with Steve Forbes and Elizabeth Ames, it is called Inflation. And we decided that we should write it because we could see that there was going to be a problem. And also, just been our experience over the last, throughout all of our lifetimes, but certainly the last 20 years, that just as you can see, there's a lot of confusion on this topic. And what happens when there's confusion is you just get bad responses and ineffectual responses, and it's a big mess. And you don't have to know all that much about economics to kind of smell that's sort of what's going on right now.
And they're just making stuff up. Oh, inflation isn't. It's two things. It's kind of funny. On the one hand, they're telling us there is no inflation, and then they're saying it's actually not bad.
Transitory.
Are we still talking transitory, or did we give that up already?
I don't think they give it up.
I think transitory is blown up in their face between gas and the price of food.
There actually was some rationale behind it, although it was wrong. So what we decided in the book, we wrote for really the normal people, right? It's not for policy wonks. It's not for economists, although they could learn something, too, we hope. and one of the problems is just this word, just this term, inflation, it kind of arises from popular speech. It's not really like from economists to the general public. It's kind of like the other way. And it's just become this catch-all, this stew pot of all kinds of things that might cause prices to rise broadly. And as a result, you end up talking about everything. Well, it's Federal Reserve. No, it's Vladimir Putin. No, it's the housing shortage. You just go around and around like this. And so what we really wanted to do in the book is, first we decided that we were going to break this down into two basic categories of macroeconomic processes or cause and effect mechanisms. And one is what we call non-monetary factors. And this is all the supply and demand factors that you can point a finger at. And we're having a lot of those these days. All the supply chain stuff kind of came out of COVID and long-standing things and things related to the energy sector and all these things, and we've talked about them, very tight labor markets, and sometimes the government is involved in these by creating problems one way or the other. And those really don't have anything to do with the currency per se, right? You could have a supply and demand issue without having, a currency issue. And usually in the past, we've seen this during wartime. During World War II, prices went up a lot because everyone was using everything in wartime, and fewer people making things because they're all out fighting. And you saw this also after the end of World War II when price controls were lifted and prices all jumped up like 20% in the next couple of years. Not really has that much to do with the currency. And we can kind of understand that. And that's definitely happening now, and it's really more acute than at any time since maybe World War II, so it's a little weird that way. And then we decided there's a whole another category. There's really just one factor, which is the monetary factors. And this has nothing to do with supply and demand. There's no shortages or surpluses or anything of that sort. It's just the currency. It's just the management of the currency by the central bank, or mismanagement, if you want to think of it that way. And it's really easy to understand, although this is almost never talked about. You never hear this discussed. But it's really easy to understand. It's simply a decline in the value of the currency. And in the old days, this was common when the kings would reduce the silver content of the coin. So Henry VIII, you might remember in the 16th century, King of England, during his reign, the silver content of the coinage of Britain fell from 90% silver to 30% silver. So I had 1/3 the amount of silver. Guess what happened to prices in Britain? They went up 3 times, just like you would expect. Mm-hmm. And that was the old-fashioned way of doing things. Now we kind of have, you know, our currencies are very virtual. We have paper bills, of course, but then even a lot of sort of digital stuff. And this is kind of happens in a virtual way, but it's really just a decline in the currency. And we've had these declines ever since we left the gold standard in 1971. I actually estimate the value of the dollar today, at least compared to gold, is actually about 1/50th of what it was worth in the 60s. We actually have a 2-cent dollar. CPI doesn't quite say that, but I think that's actually what's going on. And just as the long-term trend has been toward declining currency value over time, so too, we had another episode in that long, sordid tale when central banks got very busy during COVID in 2020. They actually created quite a lot of money out of nowhere. The money supply increased by quite a lot in their response to that. Just as you might expect, when there's a lot more of something, its value may decline, and it did decline. And when that happens, prices all adjust over time to compensate, just like Henry VIII. It doesn't happen overnight, but over months and years afterwards, the prices rise higher to adjust to the new value of the currency, and that's what also is happening right now.
Yeah, because I think everybody is talking about the amount of money that's been pumped into the economy in the last couple of years, actually longer than that, but this flooding of the economy of free money and no labor, I think everybody knew eventually that was going to catch up with us. And is that what's happening?
Essentially, yes. It's a little... there have been times in the past over the last 10 years when there has been an apparent increase in the money supply, and real, it's not just apparent. But there wasn't that much decline in currency value that resulted. So they're kind of all sitting around like, oh, well, you know, what's going on? So you have to understand that as a process of supply and demand, like any market, resulting in a decline in the value, which I think did happen in 2020 and actually late 2019. So yeah, that's basically the process that's gone on. And it's pretty easy to understand, really. But you don't hear it described very accurately, even among the expert class.
Okay, if you had to pick the one thing that just makes you want to, you know, shoot your television set about inflation, what is it? I would imagine there are a lot of options here.
The monetary side of inflation is the most persistent because that is kind of, if you just imagine it, if the value of your money goes down, then doesn't the value of your wages go down? Doesn't the value of your savings account, your bonds, pension, you know, benefits and everything go down? Yeah, it makes you poorer. But you don't, and we all can see this happening. It's happening to us. But you never really hear about this. And the traditional solution in the past was, yeah, just don't do that. Keep the currency stable in value, which we used to do before 1971. We kept the currency stable versus gold. That's the way we did it. But we don't want to give that up, right? We've institutionalized this thing where, no, we don't have a currency of stable value. You have a currency that declines in value from time to time. There's some kind of crisis. There's a recession. There's something happens. And we get yet another step down in currency value with the same old result. And now it's kind of institutionalized, right? Now they say, oh, yeah, we want continuous inflation. We want 2% a year. Not a lot. Everyone gets angry at us. But we have this sort of long-term deterioration of our – we don't have stable currency. We have this long-term deterioration in the value of our currency. And that's something that we never talked about.
Do you think, in light of the influx of money and so forth with the central banks, have we hit kind of the bottom as far as inflation goes? Do you think it's going to go higher yet, or are we still or have we stabilized?
Well, that's a good question, and of course, there are a lot of, you know, people are trying to guess this. I would say that for now, so we had this big bump up in essentially money supply. A very aggressive response during 2020 when kind of everything was going haywire during COVID. And then by the early 2021, they kind of realized it went overboard. And they didn't really want to take it back because that could, they thought that would probably be a recession. But they said, you know, okay, no mas, right? Let's just hold the line here, not do any more stupid stuff. And so actually in the last couple of years, although the effects of that sort of decrease in the currency and the effects of that burst of money creation are now being felt today. There's a time lag. But in the last year and a half or so, I would say, the Federal Reserve and other central banks worldwide have actually been pretty responsible. You know, they've taken a much more cautious stance. They don't want to build upon the prior error. So that's kind of where they are now. And if they continue to do that, then things will probably abate. And a lot of these supply chain issues and other non-monetary factors I was talking about, in the past, they've gone away pretty quickly. I mean, when in your life have car dealerships had no inventory on the lot?
Yeah, right? No kidding.
That never happens, right?
And not only had no inventory, no new inventory. I mean, they've got no new inventory, and then they've got, like, some old stuff, and you're like, what the heck?
Yeah, we've never seen that before, or at least in modern times.
Now, if you live in a town for a long time, you kind of know who has what. And you like this one car lot here in town, we were sitting there at the stoplight, and you look over, and the cars are just getting spread farther apart. It's like, oh my gosh, look over there. It's like, it looks the same, but then when you really look at it, you're like, wait a minute, they have like half the cars. They're just, like, everybody's got, you know, they could open the doors in both cars, and they would, like, not actually hit each other. Not awesome. I'm thinking, what a bad day to be a car guy.
Yeah.
Nathan, we've got to take a really quick break, and then we'll be right back. I found the perfect song for your book, though. We'll come back with that in case you ever make it a musical or anything. I think the Gatlin brothers got you covered.
All right.
We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People, and you can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
.us.
So if you're dreaming about California, it don't matter at all where you played before. California's a brand new game.
That's a whole new topic there.
Yeah, that's a whole different topic.
Let me tell you.
The train wreck of train wrecks. But yeah, you know, in just case you make it a musical, there are, you know, some good gold songs out there. Hey, Nathan, I was looking at this one, the one clip that that Stephen had highlighted, and he said, inflation argues that the best way to end inflation and spur economic growth is through a return to the sound dollar anchored by gold. It kind of goes from there, but...
yeah, is that even possible?
And what would that look like? What would it do?
I think there's a lot of misconceptions about it. I'm going to make it real simple for Americans, your listeners. Like I said, I wrote 3 books about the gold standard. We did this for almost 2 centuries up until 1971, so
right.
It was possible. Got really wealthy doing it. And the last decade, the 1960s, there was no problem. It was one of the most prosperous decades of the last century. So it worked in the past. But they say, we can't do that now. Well, obviously there's political issues, but you got to get Congress to pass or whatever. In practice, all it really means is that you keep the dollar stable versus gold. Well, there are actually over 100 countries today that keep their currency stable typically versus the euro or the dollar. And the IMF actually banned the gold standard. Those countries are actually banned by the IMF from linking their currencies to gold. So they kind of we'll link to the dollar. And so what they're doing today is basically what we used to do. We said, well, no, we don't want our local homegrown central banker kind of making stuff up as he goes along, and we have this floating fiat currency that his short-term value is uncertain and the long-term value keeps on going down. Well, we don't want that because many of the countries used to have that. We're just going to link the value of our currency to some reasonably reliable external definite standard, U.S. dollar, gold, and hope for the best because it works out.
And hope for the best. Well. Yeah, sure.
And we can't predict the future, but something that works in the past for hundreds of years usually, it don't work okay. And that's really all there is to it. If countries can do it today, linking their currency to the euro, why can't we link to gold? Basically, we can, without getting into all these. I wrote books about the details. You don't have the whole details. But, yeah, it's not that hard. And the results are great for business. What it would do, of course, is it prevents the government or central bank from responding to recessions or other economic challenges with kind of money manipulation. You can no longer manipulate the money. It's just linked to gold. It's done, right? It's like the foot. It has 12 inches. Okay, we got that. We're done, right? And your money is like that. It becomes a stable unit of commerce, just like a foot, just like a meter, like a minute, like a, a kilogram. It's no longer this thing that's being manipulated by some goofballs in Washington, D.C., depending on what yesterday's headlines were. And if you think about that, that's good for business, right? If we do business, we just use money the way we use the meter. I want 2 meters of pipe. Okay, great. I'm going to borrow, $2,000. Okay, great. Just as you can imagine, things work really well. That's how we became the wealthiest country in the history of the world. And now, if you look at statistics, it kind of looks like the average American worker has kind of gone nowhere since 1970. And, you kind of guess why. So that's the big picture. Absolutely, we can do it when we decide to. And the most important thing for Americans today, because, Congress is not going to pass it tomorrow, but the most important thing, I think, for Americans today is to say, yes, we want stable, the principle of stable money, unchanging money, which we used to do for centuries. We want that. We don't want, whoever it is, Jay Powell, Ben Bernanke's, funny money that he's always, playing games with us with. We don't want that. You got to start with that. You got to start with principles.
I just think that... Okay, go ahead.
There's so many dollars out there now. How much gold would it take to back every American dollar with gold? That's why I say I'm not sure that's even possible anymore.
Basically what you're asking is reserve coverage.
Right.
And at no point, at no time in U.S. history has there ever been 100% backing of dollars. And in fact, before the Federal Reserve was created in 1913, paper money was actually created by private banks like Wells Fargo. They existed. They actually were in the money printing business. And Chase and banks like this. And there are actually over 1,000 of them making their own banknotes, creating the money. And they were redeemable in gold. You go to the counter at the bank, you go to Wells Fargo at the counter and say, I got some of your banknotes, I want some gold in return. And they would give it to you, just as they do for your bank deposits. But they never had all that much gold in the safe.
Right.
Some people say it was 2% of their outstanding liability, which I think is probably kind of slim. But the point is, this idea that you need fountains of gold in the vault is not really necessary. In fact, it's never been true. What you need to do is to maintain the value of the currency at the standard. And if you think about it, it's just like your bank deposit, just like your checking account, your savings account, right? We all know there isn't a stack of $20 bills in a vault somewhere that 100% corresponds to the balance in your checking account. We know that, right?
Right. So if we all showed up on the same day.
Well, I don't know. Yeah. My checking account, there's probably enough in there, but.
How would know? You're not in charge of it.
But when you go to the bank and you ask for to withdraw money in cash, or you go to ATM, or most commonly, and you ask to withdraw money from cash, they always deliver, right?
Sure.
And if they didn't have the cash, if they literally didn't have the cash in the vault so they could build the ATM, what would they do? they borrow it. Well, no, actually, you can do that. You know, the federal government could just get more gold from somewhere else. And, you know, it's not limited. It's not like there's a certain amount that's limited to that for all time. You could just pick some up off the market and give it back to the market just as banks do. And, in fact, central banks and commercial banks did this in the past. So this is like 19th century technology, right? We've done all this. It's not really that complicated.
So back when the dollar was backed by gold, gold was also, it didn't really fluctuate in value very much. I mean, it was like $32 an ounce forever. And then we went off the gold standard, and now what's gold, $1,800 an ounce? Is that, I mean, is that, you think that's a real number that is a real value for gold?
What we have essentially is what is known with economists as the money illusion. So we naturally, money is a human creation. It doesn't, you know, gold is a mineral, but money is something that right. humans created. Iron is a mineral, but we create automobiles out of steel. And our ideal of money is something that is, it's our inherent ideal of money is something that is stable in value. And we just assume that it is. So, for example, when we see that the price of gold go from $35 in the 1960s to, about $1,800 today. Did the gold become 50 times more valuable? And I just suggested that it didn't. No, what actually happened, almost all of that, is essentially your dollar losing value. It now takes 50 times more dollars to buy an ounce of gold, not because gold changed, but because your dollar did.
Right.
That's what this process has been. And, a barrel of oil is $3 in the 1960s. Now it's $100. What happens? We still drive gas guzzlers. We still drive Cadillac Escalades and stuff, which is just like the lifted version of the Cadillac Eldorado from 1965.
Right.
Oil is still fundamentally cheap in some way, or we would have looking cars. Essentially, just the dollar has lost value over that time, and so much of. Can you just imagine if there was some forget about gold. If there was some perfect, ideal, fantastic standard of unchanging monetary value, whatever that was, like a meter, right? It's just an unchanging value. And the dollar is a floating fiat currency. We all know this. We all know it goes up and down in value. It's supposed to do that. That's what it is. Then the exchange rate between the dollar and that perfect ideal, the meter, would be fluctuating, right? And that's essentially largely what we see in the dollar gold price.
Okay. All right, well, that makes sense.
That's kind of interesting. So, all right, so for people that are looking at where this might go, kind of based on the policy that they've been doing, what do you think is going to happen?
Right, where this might go. So I was getting, before the commercial break, I was kind of getting at, but they're kind of trying to be responsible right now, and so arguably the supply chain issues would be resolved, although it kind of seems like it's worse, not better. But,
yeah.
And then maybe the inflation issue would fade away, kind of like the people are saying. And that's possible. But my concern is really, there's really two things. One is seems like we're kind of sliding into recession in here. And what happens in a recession? Haven't we seen this movie before? Doesn't the federal government step up with, crazy spending programs?
Yeah.
Doesn't the central bank get busy with all kinds of very, very lax, very easy monetary policies, and in fact even create large amounts of money like they did in 2020? And in effect, although there wasn't a direct connection, indirectly what they did is the Federal Reserve created money to pay for the federal spending programs in 2020. And might that happen again? Even if it's just one third amount as what happened before, isn't that the pattern we've all gotten used to? And if it is, then we're probably, I could say, pretty confident that we're going to have another burst of inflation, and it will be worse than what we've had so far.
Well,
now, is that what you would call hyperinflation?
No, that's actually the next topic. So it's just kind of a typical recession response, although it's getting bigger and bigger. Every time we have a recession, the response gets bigger. But we actually have another issue now, that which is actually kind of becoming pretty acute, not just in the U.S., but around the world. And although we have the same factors in the U.S., they're actually worse elsewhere, notably in Japan. And that is, we have a ton of debt, which we built up over time. And we have all these entitlement programs, and, you know, which are causing persistent deficits. And on top of that, now we have some rising interest rates. So the interest rate, the interest cost on the debt held by the federal government, which is really low for a long time, is now galloping higher dramatically because not only do you have more debt, but you're paying more on all each amount of each $1 trillion of debt. And that is looks like it's going to blow out the deficit to 4 to 6%, even without a recession. So we just have, like, you know, 4 to 6%, maybe even higher, 7% deficit all the time. Well, you know, it doesn't take too much of that before governments in the past, other governments, have increasingly relied on the printing press to finance all this. And that's what divides inflation from hyperinflation. The thing that causes prices to go way, way up in a hyperinflation is gigantic increases in the quantity of money. And the gigantic increases in the quantity of money don't come about because people got around the table like a bunch of economists and say, you know, I think the best thing to do would be have hyperinflation. Right? That never happened. What happened is they had to pay some bills, and they created the money to pay the bills. And we're getting a lot of governments around the world, including us, the United States, are kind of going down that path. And it's not, we're not really that far from doing that. And I think that's possible in the next 10 years.
No, that is the cycle. I mean, I can see that coming. That they're gonna make another run at printing a whole bunch more money, which is gonna create,
and all the crazy programs. Let's create all the free money programs, which, you know, just really cuts the legs out from under private industry. And
yeah.
And that's the and I mean, in the one part, I don't remember which part of it that I was reading, but your answer was, you know, spur private industry and get economic growth back on track, and then we can solve some of this.
Yeah, and you could, it kind of depends on your outlook. If you could say, well, one of the goals we had of writing the book is, well, maybe we can avoid that outcome. I kind of think we're not going to change the course of history much, but maybe we can avoid that outcome. But the second reason for writing the book is to say, well, what if all that happened? Then what? Then the thing that comes afterwards. And there have been, as you mentioned in the book, there have been countries in the past that have gotten into hyperinflation. Both Germany and Japan had hyperinflation after World War II. Not during World War II, but actually afterwards when they were under U.S. occupation. In 1949, they both had hyperinflation. So what did they do? They had a very clear strategy. The first thing they did is they passed a law that the government could not issue any more debt. They could not spend any money unless they previously received the money in the form of tax revenue. So they cut up all the credit cards. Well, that obviously relieved the need to print any money, right? But they had to have this big overhaul of spending. So they did that. And Japan actually kept those laws until 1965. They had 15 years where they did that. And then they fixed the inflation problem by putting the currency back on the gold standard, yen, when yen was linked to gold and the German mark was linked to gold in 1949. So that fixed the inflation problem. And then they reduced taxes a lot. They had huge, huge tax reductions because they said, hey, they were sitting in rubble, essentially.
Right.
Not because of the war, but because of the economic disaster that followed the war, which prevented any rebuilding. And he said, well, we're not going to get any more high taxes. We're going to have strong business, so let's cut taxes. And they had huge, huge booms as a result. And if we get into trouble, and we should remember that strategy because it works.
Yeah. For some reason, we're not really good at doing the things that work over and over. We have this evil tendency to do the things that cause a little train wreck. I would be very curious to know, we have to take another quick break, one last one. But I would be very curious to know how you view this, like through the lens of the Jimmy Carter era. because it just sort of feels like we're doing that all over again. And maybe because I was in high school at that time, and I look at some of this and I think, oh my gosh, it's the same deal. Cars were really expensive. We were just getting out of school. I think home loans were in the 20-21% at that time. So here we had gotten our education. We got out of college, and it was like, well, now we, you know, we can't afford to do anything. All the stuff we planned for, we were basically locked out of at the time. I'd be really curious what you think of that. We'll be right back with our guest, Nathan Lewis. He has written a book with Steve Forbes and Elizabeth Ames. It is called Inflation. What is it? Why is it bad? And how do you fix it?
A story about Billy Joe and Bobby Sue. Two young lovers with nothing better to do. They'd sit around the house, get high and watch them too. And here's what happened when they decided to cut loose. They headed down to Old El Paso. I swear they ran into a great big
another hit for the musical. Inflation, the musical. All right, so Nathan, are we in Jimmy Carter times again? Is this going to go kind of that same way?
No, it's actually quite a bit different, and I'll describe.
Am I happy that it's different, or am I sad? Just spoiler alert me. Oh, I'm sad. I could tell. Never mind. Never mind. Go ahead.
Rip the Band-Aid off.
The short term is I think we're in considerably better position than we were in the late 70s. But in the bigger picture, it's worse. So let me say what I mean. So during the 1970s, the amount of dollars, number of dollars it took to buy an ounce of gold went from 35 in the 1960s, the gold standard. It was kept at 35. To about 350 in the 80s and 90s. So, you know, forget about some of the wiggles. That was kind of the average. So basically, it took 10 times more dollars to buy an ounce of gold. So I suggest what that means is that the dollar lost 90% of its value. We had a 10-to-1 decline of dollar, or it became only worth 10 cents, if you want to put it in those terms. And that's a much bigger move. That's much more serious than what we've had so far. So far, you know, the dollar was about 1,200 in 2018, and now it's about 1,800, so much more of it. And that was really driving all the action that happened in 1970s. Everything was being driven by that. There was really no commodity issue. Commodities actually kind of were laggards. They only went up about three times in price. People talked about oil shortages and all this stuff, but that really, they didn't really exist. It was just monetary. The other thing is that there weren't really many deficits in the 70s. The government kind of ran balanced budgets, or what we would consider balanced budgets today. They had a deficit of 1% of GDP or something like that. They thought it was a big deal, but we can hardly notice. And debt-to-GDP ratios in that time were pretty low, at about 30%. So federal government debt-to-GDP was about 30% then. Now it's about 120% or 100% held by the public. So we have much higher debt levels now. So... And we also have these supply chain shortage issues in energy, agriculture, in many, many things, which have resolved themselves in the past, and be getting worse today. And that's kind of new, and it's easy to assume it won't become a big deal, but it keeps getting worse. So that's something that's a little new. I cover The Economist as how we're going to run out of all this stuff. So that's kind of a new thing. And I think it might persist for a while. But in the bigger picture, we didn't have the other thing that happened is the 1970s is that the central banks, just as there weren't big deficit issues, it actually did not create that much money. Money creation was not a feature of the 70s. The currency fell in value a lot. Like I said, probably about 90%. But there wasn't really that much money printing going on. Now, what we have today is central banks around the world have gotten into this pattern of money printing. And governments have gotten into this, I think, sort of addiction behavior of just assuming that the central bank is going to be there to backstop all their spending. And we have this very high debt levels, and we don't seem to have any plan to deal with it except to ignore it and inflate it away. After World War II, we actually had 100% of GDP debt levels at the very end of World War II. But what happened? Well, the federal government cut its spending in half. Because wasn't spending on wartime anymore. And it cut taxes, and the economy boomed, and everything was great. We're not doing that, right? I don't see Congress saying, oh, you know, we have the debt problem, let's cut our spending in half.
Yeah, no.
That's not happening. They're all doubling down, right? We have deficits as far as I can see, and since we might as well have one last party, let's just spend all the money we can. It is the reaction I've seen. And like I said, this is all kind of leading toward repeating the same process. If we might be going into recession, isn't Congress going to spend these boatloads of money on stupid stuff that's a big waste of money?
Yes.
And when that happens, the central bank, even if they're reluctant, will be under a lot of pressure to make all the pain go away by printing money one way or the other. Even though right now they're kind of trying not to do that. I'll give them some credit for that. And in the bigger picture, I hate to make these kind of doomsday predictions because they're so often wrong, but it just looks to me like we are ambling down this path toward a hyperinflationary outcome. And one indicator of that recently, and Japan is actually far worse off than we are, so we're actually kind of better than most places in the world. But if you look at this, the yen has had this, the currency of Japan has had this like fall out of bed look to it recently. And the central bank and the government is reacting to this by actually stepping up their money creation. It's stepping up their government bond purchases, or basically printing money. So it looks like, at least for them, I would not be surprised. It's kind of like that hyperinflationary outcome that people have been talking about for 20 years. Is happening right now. It's not obvious yet, but it started.
Mm-hmm.
And if it started there, then other countries that look kind of similar but are not quite as bad, but they have all the same symptoms, which would be Europe next and then United States third, we might not be that far from, doing the same sort of thing. So, three to 5 years, maybe what's happening to Japan might start happening to us.
And then what do you see with the price of gold and silver then in the next 3 to 5 years?
Well, it's just the reciprocal of the currency value. I think gold throughout human history, I wrote a book about this going back 5,000 years. It's always been pretty stable in value.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly for the last 500 years, where we have more data, it's been pretty stable in value. That's why it serves as the basis of monetary systems, because it's the one thing in the world that does for money what like a meter or a kilogram does for length and weight. It's reliable. And I think it still has that quality. So if you had this hyperinflationary outcome, you got to 10,000 or $1 million or $1 billion per ounce of gold, it's just a dollar. It has nothing to do with gold. Gold is just an inert metal.
Right, right.
it just measures how much your dollar is worth. We talk about this kind of like billion-dollar banknote kind of outcome, but what Latin America experienced in the 1980s, every country south of Texas had hyperinflation in the 80s. The value of the Mexican peso went down by 100 times, went from 27 to 2,700 per dollar. So I think an outcome like that is certainly possible.
Because I look at the recent inflation numbers. I mean, the price of everything's going up. It doesn't really seem to have a lot of impact on the price of gold.
No, that happened earlier. That happened in late 2019 to 2020 when the number of dollars it takes to buy an ounce of gold went from 1,200 to about 1,800, so about 50% of it. And just as I mentioned, Henry VIII, so the natural consequence, just kind of all things being equal, you might expect from that, is for prices to rise about 50% as a consequence. It doesn't always work out that cleanly in real life, but that's kind of what we're experiencing now. Your price is rising, let's say, over a period of years, roughly 50% to as an adjustment to that prior event. But yeah, right now, actually, like I said, central banks do not seem to be letting their currency depreciate versus gold, except for Japan.
And then what do you see with interest rates? In light of what's happening now, you think the Feds are going to raise
just keep going
rates
up?
And keep going up like they did in the 70s?
That'll be interesting to see. One of the problems we have now is there's way too much focus on interest rates. And you can just let the market figure out interest rates for itself. And that's what we did in the past. What we want to do is manage and ideally stabilize the value of the currency. You never hear about that. We always hear about interest rates. But what inevitably happens eventually if a currency has a pattern of falling in value is that interest rates have to rise to compensate. Right? Investors are not just going to get devalued to oblivion. Now, I might mention that there is kind of an exception to this rule, and that is if the government steps in and buys the debt, essentially setting interest rates, then you can have very low interest rates in not only inflation, but hyperinflation. And in fact, this is what happened in Germany in the 1920s, early 1920s. You probably heard about that. The interest rate actually was 5%. Now, the CPI was at, 2,800%, but the interest rate was at 5%. And this creates all kinds of weird things.
wheelbarrows of cash.
funny things could happen there. In general, we've had extremely low interest rates. In fact, the interest rates the last 5 years, we had negative rates in Europe, and then we had after COVID, collapsing rates in the United States. These are actually the lowest interest rates in all of known human history. We have debt contracts going back to 2700 BC and probably some before then. Never have there been interest rates this low.
Yeah.
And it's basically completely abnormal situation created by central bank intervention. So just to return to normalcy, we're going to have some entire interest rates. So I wouldn't, you just kind of got to expect that and get ready for it. It was very common to have government debt at 6% in the 1990s and borrowing, borrowing for a house at 7% or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so we should be prepared for those kind of levels just to kind of get back to normal, I would say.
Well, when the interest rates are as low as they have been, it just tells people don't bother to save any money because there's no, you can't. I remember we were kids. We had a savings account, and you actually made money. Now, if you were a kid and you had money in the savings account, you might make a penny every 6 months.
And overall, you lose money when you look at the inflation factor.
Yeah, not a huge incentive.
Yeah, you have to speculate just to stay even, right? Which is very unnatural, very very problematic way of running an economy. That's why it doesn't work very well. But there might be some interesting things happening there. Historically, in the past, and in fact, this might be starting to happen right now in Russia, is that one of the reasons why we've had this cycle many times. Governments getting off of currency discipline, gold standard discipline, and debasing the coinage, printing money. China had paper money hyperinflation in the 11th century. So we've been doing this a long time. But not only do governments do the same stupid stuff over and over again, but they also fix things from time to time. And one of the reasons they fix things is that they can issue bonds in gold at low interest rates, historically the lowest possible interest rates. So that might be part of our solution. How are we going to politically get back to gold standard? Well, when no one's going to loan you money unless you pay in gold. it happens real quick.
Get your religion in a hurry.
Okay, we're on the gold standard, buddy.
Exactly.
I'll loan you 100 ounces of gold, and you can pay me 105 back a year from now. Literally, that's how it works.
Problem solved. Oh my gosh, we are we're about a minute out, and I didn't want to leave without having you promote your newsletter at the newworldeconomics.com. What can if people sign up for the newsletter, like one a week, 15 a day? Like, what are we looking at?
No, it's a traditional monthly newsletter with some occasional add-ons. And it's hosted by Substack. It's pretty affordable. People often ask me, because I actually have a history of investing and manage money right now. Always asking my investing opinion, so now you can get it. It doesn't cost very much.
That's fun.
NewWorldEconomics.com.
All right. Well, you know, a lot of times when you say, hey, there's a mailing list, and people are like, oh, my God, I don't want any more email. But I was assuming that this was a fairly, conservative number of emails. How about that? We're really grateful that you popped on with us. And
yeah, great information.
Super good information. We hope to speak with you again. And best of luck on the book, Inflation. And our guest has been Nathan Lewis. You can find this later on this afternoon, commercial free at WeHavePeopleRadio.us.